You're listening to BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
Here with me in the studios is Dr. Reza Azmi of Wild Asia. Good morning, Dr. Reza. Welcome, and let's start immediately. Everybody's excited. We are excited, actually, in here at the BFM office. Tell us, what's Wild Asia? When? How did you start it? Why did you start it? All that.
It's one of these.
It has to be because we're
difficult
questions. You're here to educate everybody. You know, this is an important thing that you're doing. So tell us.
Well, basically, Wild Asia was set up as a social enterprise probably around 2003. But we have been online through various websites, wildborneo.net in about 1998. And that evolved into wildasia.net in about 2003. So the whole basis of us setting up was really about communication, about bringing people together to share, I guess, our interest in natural areas, our interest in the people, the cultures around us. But yet at the same time, also see, well, why isn't travelers going more to local people? You know, why are they always using, foreign agents, the bigger businesses? I mean, that was the sort of starting point for us in the first place.
Yeah, but for you as a founder, I mean, what was the trigger point? I mean, I understand what you're saying in terms of, the general principles behind setting this up. But for you, what was it? Because for most people, when they start something, either something happened or they saw something or it affected somebody close to them. What was the trigger point for you?
I guess it was, at that time, like 98, I was spending a lot of time actually in the Kinabatangan and Sabah. So here was, you had forest areas and you had this amazing river that flowed up, the longest in Sabah and things. Mm. And at the same time, you had these cultures and people who, you were suddenly finding Ibans in Bukit Garam, which is kind of where I was working. And actually what that whole bit of exposure sort of was teaching me was actually how things change. And things change really because of business opportunities. And the reason why you had an Iban guy sitting in Sabah in the middle of nowhere was really because of forestry. So, in the 1940s and 50s, timber camps was the mainstay in that part of the world. And that's why people move. And that's why, little villages started appearing here and there. I mean, so you had this sort of flux in terms of people, and flux came with the change in sort of economic activities. And at the same time, you had tourism. Tourism was starting to slowly develop in that region. And suddenly you saw a lot more foreign tourists. Suddenly you saw also at the same time, ironically, the sort of slow almost carving out of whatever forest areas that was left that was going into agriculture. So I guess 1998 was a turning point for many things. I mean, for me, it was this realization that was this flux change that was happening.
And so it was better to sort of organize something to help manage that change in a more sustainable way rather than letting it just happen to them.
Yeah, you can't deal with all these big problems. So I thought, well, let's start by can we find a voice by linking people up?
Right.
And that was the basis. I mean, because that was wildborneo.net. And we set up as an internet site. Mm-hmm. We had no money and things like that. But that was, from day one, as soon as I started publishing, I started some stories of what's going on in where I was. And, here's some nice travel destinations and da-da-da. And from there, you found that, people were sort of writing to us and saying, well, I have something to share. And we were then getting some response from travelers. We were getting some response from different people. And it kind of just grew out of hand from there. And like today we have, God knows how many contributors. We've gone from 40 to, hundreds. Our visitors to the site, range well over 6,000 in a day. The readership has grown and suddenly now people, when I talk to people and I say, look, I'm from Wild Asia, they actually have a hint of recognition about what I'm talking about. Like, but 10 years ago, 5 years ago, there was, who?
Well, who? Yeah. Okay, but are you then seeing this as a business? Because the kind of growth that you're talking about, things, it seems to be very organic. It seems to be, well, whatever's going to happen is going to happen. Yes, we're very happy, but, the idea is to spread the word rather than to run this as a business. And yet, you've incorporated a Sindri and Berhad, the company Wild Asia Sindri and Berhad. Why use that as a vehicle rather than remain as just an organization, an NGO-styled entity?
I think, my background has been with different charities, and a lot of my work actually, and still is actually, engaging with, you know, conservation organizations and helping them and things like that. And when we needed to form, because imagine, in 1998 I started, and it was a website. But every time I met people, especially government people, as soon as you say you're an individual, it's like, oh, okay, well, there's my door.
Right.
You know, so you didn't really have any sort of point of engagement.
Right.
And so we felt that, okay, like, let's start this properly. And there's actually not very many options. I mean, to set up as a formal charity, et cetera, that becomes quite... I mean, that's like a whole different ballgame in itself.
Well, there could have been a foundation, a trust, a kind of...
A foundation needs a million.
I know,
it needs,
I know.
You know, so
under
it,
our current...
When you're like 20-something years old, you know, you don't often have, you know, rich friends, nor do you have, you know, sort of a million sort of stacked away cash somewhere. So we decided, well, let's go for this business model because it's easier to register. And
right.
What we did right from the beginning was actually say, well, as shareholders, we will not take dividends or whatever out of it.
Yeah.
So that launched our sort of social charter. So it is a company, but it's not a company there for gain in terms of as shareholders.
So you're acting more like trustees, actually.
It is. So this year we're trying to figure out, well, how do you legalize that? And so over the last, from 2003 to today, and in fact, like this year was the first year, we actually did a round of planning where we finally realized that actually we do have a social charter.
Right.
And the social charters are about influencing change. And that's why a lot of what we do actually engages businesses, because we felt that maybe that's where we could get some spark of hope. Another big part of our social charter is actually about nurturing. So we have seed grants, which we give out to smaller projects, to individuals who are trying to do something, but they just need a helping hand.
Sure.
Nor do they have time to write complicated grant proposals. We also do a lot of nurturing in-house. I mean, we have a very young team. So suddenly you realize that, you know, when I talk about sustainability, there's a sort of slight blank look, you know, but I thought you meant environment. You know, we can understand environment, but sustainability is a lot more complicated. Then the last part, which is really where we started, was the sort of sharing aspects as a social charter. So we share through the website, and that's really a big part of what we do. But over the years, we've started doing workshops not for, you know, for school children and things, but really for corporate, and starting to show them, you know, images and things that we have seen on the ground, which a lot of people don't see, and trying to make that connection to switch them on as to, well, you as a business operation, what can you do?
Are you finding a more of a buy-in now that you're established, you've got the company behind you, you've got, I guess, a more tangible kind of entity that people can relate to, and not necessarily just one person who's going to take our money and run off with it to Borneo? Is there more of a buy-in? Do companies actually come to you rather than you having to approach them?
Well, they do. And I think, but that, when I talk to business people, they tell me that ad hoc, you hoping that somebody walks in the door does not work, especially when you start having responsibilities.
Right.
And today we're very scared. I mean, you know, you've got an operating cost that suddenly goes up into,
sure,
you know, half a million or more. How do you raise that kind of money? And so now we're coming at the end of the year. You have all these markets coming tumbling down. And in some ways, you still have mouths to feed and people's, you know. So suddenly it's like, it's not really very straightforward, but it's a challenge. And we're excited that, you know, we still have people who believe in us. And it's a great opportunity even to be here in some ways. I mean, all the people can't see us, but I think it's always great to meet people face to face. That sort of connection thing, I think, really makes sense. And
well,
I think that's what we're all about.
They're going to hear it in your voice as well, because, I mean, if someone's going to be just fake and talking about it, and as opposed to someone who's like talking from the heart, I think it does make a difference. So people who are listening to you can hear you. I mean, it sounds odd saying that because you're on radio, but they can hear you. I'm just wondering, though, are people out there saying, despite the conditions, and you've still got people who want to contribute, are they saying, well, here's some money, take that and do what you need to do? Or are they saying, well, I don't want just the money because I believe in what you're doing. I want you to come and run a workshop, do something. I want to buy into a project. I want to own a project and work on it. What's the ratio of response?
Right. Well, I guess because we're structured as a social enterprise. I mean, we don't really ask for money. We don't ask for donor grants to, you know, just give us money and then we'll save the world.
That's but not, you've got operating expenses.
Yeah, but I mean, I say that's not my model. What we are sitting on is, yes, we would like to work with you. We want to engage you. And we can engage you by basically raising awareness from the models or the field experiences that we have, whether it's biodiversity, people issues, and things like that. And that risk, that side of things has slowly been picking up. I mean, this year we had 2 to 3 major sort of corporations who said, well, let's listen to what you have to say about responsible tourism. And what they didn't realize was my responsible tourism workshop actually gives you a very good sort of introduction into how do you deal with environmental issues? How do you deal with social issues, your staff, from your workforce to management issues? And then how do you deal with your customers, which is your consumers? Because you have to make this real in order for it to be, I guess, rewarding as you as a business owner, but then secondly, for your staff in the first place. So that's our sort of eureka moment this year. You know, we've spent years just thinking about, well, how does a responsible tourism business operate and how should they operate? And we've come to the point now where we've traveled all over the region. This year, our team has gone to the Philippines, India, Sri Lanka, Thailand, all these places. And what we've come back with is those insights. You know, how do you run a business? And these are not small businesses. I mean, some of these are multi-million dollar businesses. So if they can do it, can't we not learn from it? So this is, I think, really our sort of position. We are all about model building, and we're all about learning from different people, and we want to be able to package it to sell, to inspire other people, which is the foundation of, you know, either our responsible tourism work. It's the foundation for our work with the oil palm companies. And more, actually, is also engaging with other corporates in different sectors. But the basics is there. And I mean, something I was reading last night was actually a very simple thing, that we can dissect all these big environmental issues, you know, from mass pollution in different places and things like that. But it actually comes down to just losing connection, the business losing touch with its environment. And I really see that that must be the way forward, you know, to find where businesses operate and start from there.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station. You're listening to BFM 89.9, The Business Station.
You're listening to Dr. Reza Azmi, who is the founder and director of Wild Asia. Let's go to some specifics now. Let's talk about some of the projects. What do you want to start with? Rethink Travel or the Tanah Merah? Which, I mean, pick a project, sure. And yeah.
Well, I guess I have been talking about the sort of Rethink Travel thing. I mean, Rethink Travel is actually
but
a new
in the context of working with an organization. We're allowed to mention names. Yes.
I actually have no idea, but
You know, are they shy, the organization that pick with?
Well, I don't know. I mean, we can talk about estates,
right.
And actually for as I said, you know, we're into model building. And one of those nice models was actually this work we did with Tanah Merah.
Yes.
And he was in a state, sitting in a state which has lost quite a lot of its forest areas. And in fact, around it, the immediate vicinity, you really didn't have very much, except the plantation had gone, I guess this is decision making that from, you know, many years ago, to leave aside a hill, which was a small forested hill. And that, to them, was their starting point. That's why they invited us there in the first place. But when we visited, we realized that, hang on a minute, you've got rivers that flow through your estate. And just beyond your borders is the entire sort of mangrove stream area. So you had mangrove forests, you have this river system that, you know, you saw locals going in to harvest fish and shellfish. Further downstream, you had this thriving fishing community. So suddenly we realized that, okay, well, here might be Little Malaysia. If you could deal with the estate, could you make an impact to the entire sort of downstream community? And we're talking sort of in ecological terms. So that was the sort of, that's what set the vision for Tanah Merah. And this year was the first year we actually ran it. I mean, we've been talking and trying to get buy-in. And in some ways, what was exciting about that journey from 2004 was actually we were not doing the selling. We had inspired a couple of managers with pictures of what was there on the estate and what we could do and where could we go and why this was important, things like that. And they were taking our presentations and then presenting it at any opportunity. And then suddenly you find, you know, that it ended up with the chairman of this company. And then the ball started rolling. So this year we actually had the sort of time on the ground and we focused on a few things. I mean, trying to look into the sort of education aspect where how do you relate the estate to the schools nearby? So we created this program. It's completely out of the box, looking at from the hills to the sea. We engaged a small Tamil school who, I mean, I think till today the headmaster is probably wondering, you know, what did I let in? But it was exciting. I mean, it was exciting to try something new. And the second big thing we did was this whole tree planting idea. Mm. And the tree planting thing was just simply creating seed banks on somebody else's land. But the idea is the guy who's responsible for nurturing it, not for 1 year, but it's for the next 5 to 10 years, is actually the landowner. So it's a big deal in itself.
Yes, very much.
You know, to have agreed to do that in the first place. And what was exciting was we were able to reach out to a whole bunch of other people. We actually ran this campaign with AMP Radio, which I'm sure you guys want to run with us for next year.
Sure we do.
And that was great. So suddenly I was in Sabah and I heard, oh yeah, you guys are doing something at Tanah Merah, planting a tree. And that sort of really sold the whole thing because you suddenly had interest. And that outside interest ignited the fellas on the ground. You know, so we're talking here about managers, assistants, workers. For the workers to suddenly be right next to some celebrity was a big deal.
Right.
And because you had, you know, AMP had, there was a Tamil, Chinese, you know, the sort of whole Mohiba crowd, it also meant that you had this different population in the estate where there was always somebody that had a following of people.
Right.
So that to me was quite exciting. So these things are completely unplanned. All we had was we have the vision. It might take 5, 10, whatever years. But it was exciting that we were able to motivate so many people. And my sort of feel-good moment this year, I think, has to be sort of Tanah Merah, the little school, the Tamil school. And we had the closing ceremony there. And one of the things the teacher said to me was, all the kids that followed the program, their communication skills went up. Their science grades went up.
Wow.
And it was almost like, you know, just giving them some creativity, you know, just allowing them some freedom to think and explore nature and pick up, you know, these shells and all these things that we managed to sort of to pull together.
Yeah.
And this year has been a big sort of pull together moment because you can imagine we're a very small team.
Sure. No, it's really quite impressive. And I like the approach. I mean, I'm going through some of the things and seeing, like, you know, it's not the usual environmentalists against palm oil plantations, but rather like, okay, you've got a business to run and it's here, but how do we make this more sustainable? How do we engage communities that are living around this area so everybody's happy, kind of thing? And that obviously seems to be the approach that works, you know. Let's talk now about taking it beyond. I see that you've got this new one, 11. com
that's
due to be launched. I'm personally interested in that. But talk a little bit about that.
Well,
the craft.
You know, when I was saying how we have three social charters, and one of them is actually on nurturing.
Yeah.
And it's quite exciting for me to finally be able to tell people about actually a partner program. It's not even ours. But they share an office space with us. But beyond that, we've always been in touch. And 11 actually is a sort of culmination of several major sort of real good initiatives. And the first actually lies with Garai OA. I don't know whether you've heard of that.
Yes.
And there's a remarkable lady there who's been driving this for the last, you know,
3 to 4 years.
I can't remember how long, you know. Yeah. But it's personal commitment. She doesn't drive. So sometimes our gang does and other people, we drive her into the village, or those with four-wheel drives would then, you know, we'll get SMSs saying, you know, I need to go into this Tasik Bura village, blah, blah, blah. And then she goes. So she visits the artisans herself. There's product development going on, you know, in the sense that, you know, here's some these ideas work or these colors work. Or the artisans might say to her, well, I don't have this dye, which she then thinks, oh, yeah, I remember so much so-and-so somewhere has. You know, so then kind of just build making that network work. But you can't mimic this because there's only one Rita.
Absolutely.
But what she has done is at least she's inspired the sort of foundations of 11, which is how can you create then this sort of marketing platform where people can buy, almost buy direct, and they're buying direct from the artisans themselves.
That's right.
And then the second thing is, I mean, they just had another posting recently where when you see the artisans themselves, and sometimes they're faced with immediate life issues. Rains are coming. I don't have a proper house. You know, I don't have a roof. So what the plea that came out, I think about last week, was you need 2,000 or 3,000 ringgit to go and solve this house problem,
yes.
So there was a call that went out, and it went out on Facebook. It went out on all these different things.
Yes.
So it'll be interesting to see what response we actually get from this. But there, again, it's a network. And it's a network that could not exist if you did not have A, people like Rita, B, the community organizers who are already working with these communities. So you realize that 11, you know, like us, are actually networks. We are channels.
Yeah. Well, you know, I think for them, they looked at it and like, okay, yeah, I know it's so difficult to do this, but let's just go out and do it. So I think what you've really started is has been like a catalyst, if you like. And now the work is not only being done by ourselves, but it's been channeled to other organizations, which is great. Let's run off this interview by talking a little bit about your Responsible Tourism Awards. I mean, does that work? Do you get, tour agencies, tour operators, and people buying in because they said, ooh, we might actually win an award because of this?
Well, actually, I mean, that's exactly how it sort of started. I mean, our responsible tourism work is actually based on a sort of checklist that we did. So this checklist is sort of a fairly global checklist of environment, social, whatever issues. And we've been trying to get people to fill this in, and we weren't really getting much of a response. So this is pre-2006. So 2006, we sat back. We had some British government funding, which was great. I mean, and they had the flexibility of basically saying, right, we understand that what you're trying to do doesn't work, and we understand that if you want to shift your strategies, fine, try it. And that gave us the confidence basically to launch the first awards, which was in 2006. And from that moment onwards, it's just grown every single year. And the other thing which has come from this is actually very good media response. So first year, we had 50 minutes on BBC. So we were there on, you know, one of their big travel channels first year. And, you know, people are struggling to get sort of media space, et cetera, et cetera. And so this year is year three. We've got a much wider coverage. We've had good response internally from Malaysia. But, you know, we're looking at models. So some of the Malaysian models does not stand up to what we see in India, what we see in Thailand and places. But it doesn't matter because the point is that we have now learned what makes those things work. So if people have an interest to move in this direction, then that's where the DVDs on the site, they can download, attend our talks, attend our workshops, which is quite soon in November, and all these different things. So it's kind of like, you know, we're saying go and do it, but also here's how. And I think that's a useful sort of balance to have. And so we're not preaching. So I'm not preaching here either.
No, you're not. You're educating us, which is really quite a different thing. But we've got to move on to the news. Before I go, I think it's important to tell people where they can find you. Is there a contact number or a website they can go to? Tell them that.
Well, wildasia.net. And net is very important. So remember just that, .net.
All right. Wildasia.net. Go there for more information. Lots of things to learn there. Lots of things. All right. Thank you very much, Dr. Reza Azmi of Wild Asia.
Thank you.
BFM 89.9, The Business Station.